GoDaddy. Big Dog Ball Talk. Happy Father's Day to all the fathers
to
out
me.
There.
From you to me?
Is this how you're telling me this? To Paul, to the Lloyds, and all the other great fathers out there, the Arunises of the Arunis. World. Yep. We've got a lot of Big Dog Ball Talk fathers out there. luckily, Jordan and I, historically known as not fathers, and probably for the best, I could not imagine myself as a father. I certainly couldn't imagine you as a father, Jordan.
What the fuck? I'd be amazing, man. I'd be an amazing stay-at-home dad. Just do nothing.
Yes. The idea of being a stay-at-home parent or just like a trophy husband is like the dream. People like, if I was like a good looking, like supermodel guy, or if there's ladies listening, Big Dog Ball Talk ladies out there, the bitches, Big Dog
the Ball bitch Talk pound. Bitches.
Yeah, the bitchers. I appreciate everything, in the world, people want to do their own thing. But like, if I had the choice, like I could just like look so good that all I have to do is clean once in a while, cook, just stay at home and fucking do nothing. Like, I feel like you could probably just carve out 1 hour to do like a little task around the house and then be like, I was fucking hands and knees all day scrubbing the floors.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, no. So maybe that'll happen for us. I mean,
fingers crossed.
Time is moving along. Happy Father's Day. What did I do that was fathers like today? Oh, well, I'll tell you this, Matt. I went to my local ice cream shop. Got a little nice little ice cream shop here on our main street, and the flavor they had a special flavor for Father's Day: maple bacon. So maple ice cream,
disgusting. No,
with little bits of candied bacon in there.
No, I'm out.
Little unorthodox, but it was really good. I gave it a try, and it was good. It was little bits of bacon in your ice cream. Little weird, but definitely good.
Yeah, you know how there was a couple podcasts ago, you said that like I am like 100% straight, like I don't have like any gay in my body. Yes. You are 110% white. There is no melanin or any other sort of ethnicity in your blood.
Are you joking me?
Maple bacon ice cream. That's fucked.
I listen to hip hop and rap, man, and I have for years. Okay. So it's got to count for something.
Shit. He's down with the kids.
Yeah, I am. But no, don't knock it till you try it, Matt. I'll maybe if they make a little pint, I'll bring you up a little bit.
Sounds,
it's better than you think.
Nice. I just don't. I don't see the obsession of wanting bacon mixed in with my sweets.
I think
bacon just as is. Keep it the
I
way.
I agree. Actually, I think the bacon is overdone. Lots of things are overdone. Can we cool it with the hot honey? You don't need to put hot honey on everything. Chicken sandwiches in general. chicken sandwiches, people. People also, speaking of chicken, I think I've mentioned this before, a pet peeve. You don't need to spatchcock every single bird that you cook. You can roast it old fashioned. You don't need to fucking crank it open, flatten it on the grill. There's lots of trends that I'm not down with. So,
I hear you with the bacon. What the hell is a spatchcock, man?
You know,
a butterfly?
Yes. Okay. So,
same deal.
No, it's when you take a whole chicken. So this is me watching too many cooking videos.
Yeah, I need
type
to see
of people
this.
Know it's. You know, normally you just roast the chicken. You stuff it or you just put it in the oven.
Yes, yes.
It's a thing now. I swear to God, on every fucking person who puts recipes online, if you're cooking a bird, to take the backbone out and then literally flatten it, crack it down like you're a chiropractor.
Oh,
so
I have
it's all
seen
flat.
People like lean
so it all,
and they're like, you're snapping like, all the ribs and shit.
Yeah, and they're like, it cooks better this way. It cooks evenly. And I'm like, it's fine, but you don't need to do it all the time. It's just we're overdoing things constantly.
All right, well, I'm down with that anti-spatchcocking podcast.
Enough
official.
With the spatchcocking.
Yeah, enough of the too spatchcocking. Speaking of spatchcocking, doing things a different way, the Oklahoma City Thunder, in a very unconventional way, getting the crucial game for W over the Pacers on the road. And Jordan, for a little while there, I honestly was like, wow, this is the Pacers are about to go up 3-1, and this might be kind of the series here. We might be looking at the new NBA champions, but we're back now, tied series. It's essentially now just a best 2 out of 3. The way you can look at it, it's a whole new series. And there was a lot to break down, obviously a lot of big takes and controversial moments throughout this entire game, back and forth action. The one that I want to talk about first out of all this, because it was just kind of crazy that this was by far SGA's worst game, I would say. I would say even that game four, or game three, pardon me, loss was a better individual performance. And this one, you know, his assists just keep kind of getting a little bit lower, something that we've been really monitoring. Zero assists in this game and 35 points. Last player to score that much and have zero assists since Jerry West. and that's back in the late 60s there for all the listeners that you know are scrubbing through all the historical data.
I'm just surprised that we look at that Kobe never did it. Honestly.
Yes, yes, yeah. Or, I mean, hell, even MJ, there's a lot of guys out there that you'd think maybe would just have one crazy scoring performance. But, yeah, SGA still gets it done. You know, all he's doing is really just going out and getting buckets. But he looked off. This was a – it wasn't a strong game. Like, when you look at this, 50% from the field, 1-for-4 from three, 35 points. Like, you would still think if you just looked at the box score, this was a successful outing for SGA, even though he wasn't really helping on the boards or as a playmaker. Like, there were a lot of shots he took that were very ill-advised. There were some looks that he should have hit that, like, he just kind of went out the wayside. Like, it was very weird. And I'm wondering, like, if maybe some of this load is starting to catch up with him a little bit. I don't want to jump the gun. It could have just been, you know, one-off game. And, you know, it happens even to the best of the best. But this was an uncharacteristic night for SGA, even though statistically he ended up, you know, having a successful night. And he hit the big shot at the end that really, really matters.
Yes. Well, and he hit two big shots. There was the shot, the one on the baseline where he kind of stumbled and somehow got it off, making it look like, you know, a vintage shot, vintage mid-range shot he's hit all year. But it was tough to get to it initially. And then before that, the three, you know, off the pass from Jalen Williams on the right wing, that was a huge, like, that was such a huge shot for him to hit. As that was going up, I was kind of thinking, like, I think this is going to decide the game, because at that point, the Pacers were up four with, like, less than 3 minutes. And if he misses that shot and the Pacers get the rebound, they're in really good shape going down the stretch. Like, that was one he needed to have. It was nothing but net. And so, yeah, he had a great final couple minutes of this one, but I agree, up until that point, he once again looked gassed like he did down the stretch of game three. For a lot of this, he looked like, I don't know, it might have been this thing of like, oh, he's SGA, nobody can speed him up. And it's kind of like, well, maybe you need to speed yourself up a little bit, SGA. It was kind of was like what I was getting at in our last pod before this game four, where, you know, the Thunder, I feel like, maybe need to summon a little bit more than they usually have had to all year, where they sort of methodically and kind of like a serial killer just come out and beat you. They might have to get a little crazy, show some emotion, and really dig deep. And I just think, you know, SGA as their leader, as I was kind of watching this game, I was like, I don't know if he has it, but he did come through. You got to give him credit. It doesn't really matter how bad you are through the first quarter, three quarters of the game, or first 95% of a game. If your team has hung around and you can take them home, that's why he's the MVP. The assist thing though is really strange. Like I said last pod, like, you know, the two games that the Thunder had lost, he was at three assists and four assists. And then that game two, where the Thunder looked the best all they have through this entire series, he was up to eight. And I thought that was going to be a real indicator. Like if he's getting other guys involved, that's when the Thunder are going to look at their best. So the fact that they won on a zero assist night from him, where as a team, the entire Thunder had 11 assists in a game. Yep. That's absolutely crazy.
Amen. And that was also SGA's first game the entire year, regular season and post, that he didn't have an assist. So that's insane. Yep. We're talking like over, you know, we're talking almost 80 games plus at this point.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's a very strange sort of looking at the stats and seeing that, you know, OKC actually won the game. They made 3 3-pointers.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nuts. Like, it's fucking
I've heard people talking about it. Like, I don't know if that's ever even happened in a finals. I mean, obviously back in the day when, you know, in fucking 1979, when they just put the line in, there probably might have been games where there was none.
Can't have happened.
It's just that is just unheard of, especially today. I mean, even the Pacers, they only made 11, which, it, you know, is actually kind of low in terms of totals these days. But like,
especially if you take 36, holy shit.
Exactly. But, you know, the Thunder, they only get 16. Like, it's crazy. And you gotta give, I think, a lot of credit to the Indiana defense for that limiting of 3-point shots and making SGA look a little bit out of sorts, specifically Andrew Nembhard, who seems to know exactly how to guard him. And that would make sense considering, you know, how many times they've played against each other going back to when they were 9 years old, you know, and clearly, you know, on the national team as well, clearly that they just, he just knows his tendencies and knows how to sort of bother him as much as pretty much anyone that I've seen. Because, you know, at the end of that game, the Thunder were okay with the switch, the Jalen Williams SGA pick and roll, the switch of Nembhard going on to Jalen Williams after the screen, and then Nesmith being the one guarding SGA. And I think the Pacers were kind of like, from their perspective, they're like, we'll give up this switch. Nesmith might be our best, you know, on the whole perimeter defender. If he's the one guarding SGA and one-on-one, we'll take that. But SGA, actually, I think he prefers going up against Nesmith than Nembhard, just because of like the craftiness of Nembhard as a defender. He doesn't get caught like a couple times. You know, Nesmith, who fouled out of this game, just got caught with his arm in, and SGA rose up and drew the foul. That other kind of spin, like Kobe-like move where he spun to the middle and kind of double clutched it and got a foul on that shot as well. Like, Nembhard doesn't give that stuff up. So it was kind of funny, you know, the chess match at the end of this one of, you know, SGA being like, yeah, I'll take Nesmith on, and the Pacers kind of living with that as the matchup. But, you know, this was just a great way, I think, for game four to come down to the wire like this, having it be really close, and having it be a bit of a, you know, a back and forth, really competitive game. Cause that's what this series has been overall. And, you know, I've heard a lot of people say, oh, you know, this was the Pacers' chance. Now the Thunder, like, you know, they've got two of these last three games at home. You know, they are obviously the on paper, the much better team. And this was the Pacers' chance to really step on their throat. I don't actually believe that. I think the Pacers, like, you can say that about game four, sure. But also, OKC would have said that to themselves about game one. They shouldn't have lost game one on that crazy, you know, comeback by Indiana and that shot by Tyrese. So I think it's kind of evened out. But I also don't think, like, the Pacers' spirit is broken and they're like, oh, we can't beat this team.
No.
Pacers 1,000,000% think that they can beat this team, and they don't play scared of them at all.
I still think they have the momentum right now in the series.
100%. I mean, you're getting a split. You're at 2-2. You're already better than 99% of the entire, you know, world who picked OKC, you know, winning either a sweep or in five games. Six games was like a stretch for a lot of people picking this. So, I think this is a continuation after game four. This is just an incredible final series of insanely high level basketball that's really smart and physical, and like, there's lots of high level maneuvering going on. This has just been so fun to watch. And like, on the Pacers side, if you want to you know, be critical of them, like, I think they overall played a really good game, and you know, they only get to 104 points in this one. They're going up against the best defense in the NBA by a country mile, and it's like, Tyrese, he had 18. Siakam, he kind of disappeared down the stretch a little bit, but he had a really good game through most of this one. You get pretty good contributions from guys like Obi Toppin. Hit some massive
shots awesome
in the third quarter. He was great.
Good defensively too.
Yeah, 100%. And you know, you don't get the same type of Mathurin performance, obviously, but you know, he wasn't gonna go for 27 the rest of the way out here. So like, I don't even feel as if Indiana played a terrible game or like threw it away or anything like that. Like, this was, I mean, you know, it's not very high level analysis, but this was just two really evenly matched teams, you know, so far through four games going at it. And OKC just kind of did what they needed to do to even this out. Cause as we said, going into game four, they're not coming back from 3-1. I don't care what anybody says. I know they have the home court advantage. I know they're a 68 win team. There's a reason it's only happened once in the finals ever. If you go down 3-1, it's a wrap. So, you know, this was a must win for them, and they played like it. The only guy who I could say, you know, he's got to maybe pick it up a little bit is Miles Turner. He has had a pretty rough series, and specifically at the end when that game was still in the balance and it got sent back out to him off of a Halliburton drive, and he kind of pump faked and sidestepped to the left and took a three, and it was an air ball.
Yeah.
That was kind of exactly. Not a single man. And that's kind of representative of sort of his series. Also, it hurts because Nembhard was right next to him. He could have pitched that over to him, and that would have been, you know, a wide open three for a better 3-point shooter there. So, like, if there's one Pacer where I'm kind of like, okay, you're going to need to be a little bit better if they want to actually win the whole thing, it might be him. But yeah, overall, like, it's just solid performances, gritty performances on either side. It was just a really, really good basketball game.
Yeah, well, again, dude, like this, the Miles Turner 100% is like, if you're going to pinpoint someone who really needs to step up down the stretch for the Pacers, it's him. Yeah. Two rebounds, four rebounds yeah, last three games. And then his outlier pretty much through the entire playoffs. This is a guy who's 6'11", 7 feet, you know, whatever you want to say. A big boy who has good hops.
Quick interruption. You're going to keep going.
Oh, here we go. Nice. Miles Turner, this is what you're forcing on to Fleagle.
Yeah,
here.
I got a drink. My sorrow's awake. Go on, Matt.
But yeah, 9 rebounds in game 1 was his only outlier. And then you go back to the Knicks series, 2 rebounds, 3 rebounds, 4 rebounds, 3 rebounds. That's fucking ridiculous.
Yeah.
5 rebounds in game 1 as well. Like he, for some reason, his best rebounding series of the playoffs was against the Cavaliers, which had, you know, the twin bigs there in Jared Allen and Evan Mobley. So I think that is just a weird thing. Like and maybe this is something we aren't noticing. Maybe these are kind of, you know, the Steven Adams type of stat lines where back when he was on OKC, where Russ would have 15 yep. rebounds and he would have 4, but he's boxing everybody out to allow him to get there. Because then the other guy who's been super disappointing, I would say, in this series for the Pacers, that if he can elevate his game, at least offensively, because, you know, we talked about how important he is defensively with this team. But Naismith, he really needs to get, like, he has to find his jump shot again. Like a guy who in that Cavs series, like, again, that game 1 upset, he was pivotal in that entire, you know, crazy fourth quarter run. And really that whole series, he was awesome. But in this one, he's really kind of struggled to find that jumper. He hasn't broken 10 points since game 2. And then he hasn't really been shooting the rock efficiently. He hasn't shot over 50% in 3 of the 4 games this series. And on the game he did, it was just barely over at 3 for 5 from the floor. So really need to see him step it up a little bit here for the Pacers, because yeah, down the stretch there, they kind of were a little shell-shocked. They couldn't find their rhythm. I believe they were like scoreless from the field over the last 3 minutes of the game or something close to. They really just couldn't buy a bucket. And yeah, the defense obviously for the Thunder is awesome, but I wouldn't say that in this game they were playing to that level that constitutes them missing that many open shots. You know, this is a game where, again, the Thunder, as good as they are, kind of got, like, I don't want to use the luck word, I think it was the L word here, but they are, like, they are not being as dominant as they could be. They aren't thriving the way that, you know, we kind of all expected them to. It's just kind of figuring things out. Like, they're very slow to adapt to some of these changes. They listened to our, obviously the last podcast, Jordan, Mark Dagno went back to the double big lineup, nice to see. Even though, you know, Hartenstein kind of, you know, he still hovers around that 20 minute mark, but I think it was a good idea to include that. Overall, I think that they're finding their rhythm, but again, it still took a 20-point performance from Caruso to really even get anything out of the bench. Outside of him, you have a combined 7 points from the bench if you don't include Caruso there, who played starter minutes, you know, at 30 minutes in the game. So I still think the depth of the Thunder, which again was their biggest strength, pretty well, or one of their biggest strengths, I should say, throughout the season, now are in a position where their bench really is kind of hindering and hurting them because they just aren't figuring out a way to produce. Another thing, you know, to change the subject a little bit here, just on the overview of this game, you know, let me be the first to say that Scott Foster is horrible at his job. He is probably the worst referee in the NBA. Has his ties to Tim Donaghy, so I'm totally cool with Scott Foster being unemployed. I don't care. But I will say people are jumping the gun about all these foul bullshit, discrepancy calls. Like, if you watch the game, I texted you. I said I actually felt like there was a lot of calls made that shouldn't have been. And not against the Pacers. I know a lot of people were saying, the extender came in and, the Thunder had to, you know, they had to milk the ratings. They had to milk that money. They had to get to, extending the series. I don't feel like that was the case. The Pacers in the whole game only had one more personal foul in the matchup when there was the technical fouls assessed to both players. It really should have just been to Obi Toppin for shoving Isaiah Hartenstein. Hartenstein was just walked up. He didn't touch him. He didn't say anything. that was 100% instigated from Obi Toppin already on a hard foul. And there was several hard fouls. There was only the one flagrant foul called on each side. So again, equal there. I think the Pacers actually could have gotten two or three in this game. They were fouling the shit out of the Thunder. They were playing hard. But there was, I feel like there was a lot of tic-tac fouls that were called against the Thunder. I mean, the Pacers got those calls as well. But there was also a lot of missed calls on both sides. Like, I don't feel like this was a game where you watch it and it's like, oh, the refs decided this game. And that those do happen, and we do feel like we air those out. I did not feel like that at all in this game. There were some calls that were big, for sure. But I didn't feel like the refs took over this game the way that people are making it out to be. Again, I really think that is just, you know, the people who will say, oh, yeah, SGA, free throw merchant, blah, blah, blah. Like, that baseline jumper he hit probably should have just been a foul before he even shot it, because he gets caught, tripped on Naismith's foot. Because I was like, well, are they going to call this a travel or are they going to call this a foul? And then they just kind of froze up and he let them take the jumper. And, you know, the rest is history. But there was it was a very, very, very physical game. It's been a physical series. And if people are complaining and saying that the Thunder are getting gifted calls right now, I really don't agree with it. I don't think that that's a fair observation to make if you watch this game. Because, again, the fouls were pretty much as down the middle as it can possibly fucking be. So hopefully, you know, the reffing continues to be pretty much 50-50 as the series goes. And yes, it is a physical basketball. Like, basketball is supposed to be a contact sport. This is the way that should be officiated. This way it should be officiated all year long. I think that's why people are also freaking out, is because, you know, we're in this new age. Like, all these, like, TikTok using 12-year-olds that are watching basketball right now are like, oh my god, he breathed in his general direction, that should be a tech. Like, that's the era of basketball that these kids know. So I think that genuinely some people might not be doing this to be dramatic. They might actually just not know or have ever seen basketball where guys can really put their paws on each other and you know, move through some contact and not be called. If you're a young hooper listening to this, go outside, play with the your puppy friends, pound. Play in the gym. I don't want you guys pound. Yeah, I don't want you guys to call fouls ever. If you're going to call foul, you call your own foul when you foul somebody. You know you did it. Don't ever be that guy who is just going every single time you take it to the rim, calling the foul. But yeah, not to get too off topic here, but very, very physical game. Don't agree with a lot of the critiques on the officiating, though.
Yeah, I'd agree. Like, and I think what plays into that too is that there's no one on either of these teams. There's no like Embiid or fucking James Harden on either of these teams or anyone like that who really likes to foul bait. So where you get in a situation where if, you know, Scott
that's
Foster,
all those casuals talking about SGA, like guy had 10 free throws in this game. He didn't lead. He wasn't even in the top fucking, I don't think he was in the top 10 in free throws per game this year.
I know he was up there in the regular season, whatever, wherever he fell, but it wasn't like
he wasn't
anything
one.
Crazy. No. And it's like the best players and the best scorers in the league have always shot free throws and always shot a lot of free throws. It actually used to be like something, you remember, it used to be something that was like applauded, like DeMar DeRozan, when he was becoming a good scorer in this league, or
the pump fake master.
Like, it was just like, oh, look at him. Look how often he gets to the free throw line. This is great. And it's turned into this thing. And I do blame James Harden. And I do blame, even, you know, as much as I love him, I blame Chris Paul. I blame Embiid. I blame all these, you know, guys who have kind of gamed the system a little bit too much. But like, SGA is just not one of those guys. And no one on the Pacers is one of those guys. And so there's no way, like, You can have all the conspiracy theories you want about the league and, you know, how, Scott Foster can come in and extend a series. And 100% I agree, he's not a good referee, but you can only do that, you know, so much. You can't just blatantly make a call that's not actually there. Like, you can swing the 50-50 calls, but I think overall these teams, it's been pretty even officiating on both sides. And I don't see that as an issue at all. Which is another reason that's made this final series so great. Like, I really can't express enough how awesome this basketball has been with the fact that, you know, how evenly matched these two teams have turned out to be, which I know none of us thought that was the case going into it. But I think we can confidently say now, after four games, these are two incredibly evenly matched teams. Like, throw everything else out about the record and about everything, like, and people are trying to justify it. Like, OKC's young, like, they'll get it back. They haven't gotten to their game. And it's like, This is the finals. These are two teams playing at the absolute sort of top level that they can, that they're giving everything that they can give. And it's like, we don't need to explain it away. These are just two very, very evenly matched teams, two great teams, meeting, you know, in the final series of the season. And the other thing I like about it is everyone's healthy. And I know we're not going to get that every year. And injuries are kind of out of control, out of the control of, you know, teams, players, all of us a lot of the time. But so many finals, you know, in recent history have been just the main story has been, oh, this guy's been injured. Literally, everyone is out there able to play. Chet had a fucking twice looked like he was going to be done because he rolled the fuck out of his ankle, but he just got back up. You know, he's those young bones.
What was it, Jalen Williams?
Jalen Williams that fell. Holy shit. Yeah.
That was a hard one.
And he jumped right back up, which
that's what I like to see, man. Some of these other fucking hoopers, we'd be fucking laying there. They'd have the stretcher coming out.
It's because they're two young teams as well. So they're just, you know, they're ready to go. So yeah, it's just, it's been great. Yeah, I agree about the officiating. And like, if you look at more of sort of the individual performances, like Jalen Williams was awesome. Jalen Williams was so good. Again, he's he's not as efficient as I think he's ultimately going to become, like, as a player. Efficiency is, and just sort of general inconsistency is still his issue when you're talking about shot making, but he's solidly there in every other aspect of the game almost every night. Like defensively, he hustles like crazy. He's always in good position. He's so smart for a young player. You know, and I understand that the entire team had 11 assists, but he led the team in assists with a big fat three tonight. Like, and there's been games, and especially I think this was true a lot of game four and a little bit of game three as well, where he has to basically be the point guard because the Pacers are hounding SGA so heavily that, you know, Jay Will has to be the one sort of bringing the ball up. And I thought he's done a really good job and has just sort of smartly got offense going. And the fact that he had 27 points, got to the free throw line 11 times, made all of them. It's just, you know, it's he didn't get to the line 11 times. Sorry. He shot 11 free throws, if you care about that distinction. But
every time he walks up, it's 11.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other guy, like Chet, also had a great game. And he had a way better game in my mind than he did in game three when he had 20 points. Mm-hmm. Because like we talked about, he had a bunch of points early and then basically did nothing. He had some huge plays down the stretch on both sides of the ball. Couple big like putbacks, offensive rebounds at very timely times. And there was a really good sort of indication of how well that double big lineup works towards the end of this game, where Hartenstein got like a crazy tip over somebody and then Chet tipped it out, you know, at a really opportune time with just, you know, deep in the fourth quarter, I believe. And it was like, it was good to see the Thunder getting back to that more minutes with those two guys on the floor at the same time. Cause they've developed like a real chemistry, through the regular season. They know how to pass to each other, you know, on the interior. And just having two skilled, huge guys is just so, you know, such an advantage. So, you know, it was good to see them get back to that a little bit, but overall, I think Chet each game is looking a little bit more comfortable and like a little bit more like he knows what to do and is kind of cutting back on the dumb drives to the basket and the little mistakes. And he had a huge defensive play too on Nembhard driving in late where he kind of blocked it. Nembhard had to throw it so high up that he didn't really get a proper shot off. And then I think probably his biggest play series of plays were really, down the stretch of this game when Tyrese had him on a switch and was trying to shake him, trying to get by him. Chet got out on him and was on him tight enough that he couldn't do his step back three, but he didn't let him drive right past him. He was moving his feet. You know, he looked a little bit like a gazelle, but he managed to, you know, stay upright and not foul and contest. So like when Chet's looking like that, where he's kind of got the all around game going, 14 and 15 big rebounds and by far the best plus minus on the team at 14. Caruso was also 14, also incredible game by him yet again. But like Chet, when he's playing like that, no matter what else is going on the Thunder, that's when they're at their hardest to beat, because you know SGA is going to do his thing, hit his shots, and when you get a, you know, Holmgren and Jay Will, they're sort of 2A and 2B guys, you know, having what I would call, you know, at least B+ if not A games, then you can handle a lot of that other weird stuff, like the very few assists, the very few 3-point attempts, and all that. So I think, yeah, the Thunder got to, I think they've got to be in a good headspace knowing that, okay, we dropped game one at home, but we got the split on the road. We're coming back. Mm-hmm. Like you said, it's a new series. We've got two of the next three at home. I think they've got to feel confident, but again, like that, I don't feel in their heart of hearts that they think that they've solved the Pacers or that they can that they can run them off the floor by any means. Like, I think both of these teams know this is going to be, you know, more than likely going seven. I think there's going to be two more hard fought games and then one final decider. Like I said, that the Pacers, I don't think they can feel that bad about the performance. But in addition to the Turner thing, and the fact that he's just got to flat out play better, and Nesmith, like you said, just offensively, he's got to give them a little bit more, because that is what got them here, which is, you know, Nesmith shooting the hell out of it. I mean, in that Knicks series, the only reason they were able to get that game one is because he went absolutely nuclear. So he can't be sub 10 points the rest of the way. He's got to, you know, get up there to at least like 15, I would say, if not a little bit more. And, you know, he's got to contribute there for sure. But the thing I'm wondering about the Pacers is, like, there's going to be more close games or games that are going to end up being close at the end. And you have Tyrese Haliburton, who is, you know, clearly your best player. And I understand it's kind of his MO to coast through a lot of the game, feel things out. He doesn't necessarily, you know, go full out right away in the first quarter. He kind of likes to save his energy, get other guys involved, and then at the end score if he needs to. I think we might need to start, if I'm the Pacers, I'm pushing back or moving up that deadline for when he starts to sort of take over games, because it was crazy watching him at the end of this, driving past Caruso, getting all the way to the lane, driving past SGA, sometimes even, as is less likely, but sometimes even driving past Dort and getting all the way to the rim, hitting these crazy, like, reverse layups, these like high off the glass layups. And it's like, I would like to see him do that more often throughout the game, not just like in these heroic moments. Like, if he can do that, and if he can beat these incredibly skilled Thunder perimeter defenders to the basket and get layups, he needs to be doing that as much as possible. So, I mean, I know it's the classic Haliburton talking point of, like, he needs to be more aggressive, but I really do think that even just a little bit, like, just move it up to the third quarter where you start doing that rather than saving it all to the fourth. Because I think that's an element where, like, if he does that enough, the Thunder are really going to have to adjust, like, start sending even more doubles towards him, or, you know, things like that, changing their defense. And then that opens things up for other guys on the Pacers. So I think Tyrese's dominance as a scorer, it's got to be more than just like a last minute heroics type of thing. He's got to do that a little bit more, I think, if the Pacers are going to win this.
Well, the last thing I'm going to ask you here, Jordan, regarding game four, how much solitaire did you play and what was your best time?
I'm glad someone caught Stephen A doing this.
Fuck him, man. I think he's funny when he's not talking basketball. I can't remember the last time I ever heard X's and O's.
He just talks about, like, big narratives or whatever, and is a guy's superstar. And for some reason, it never got on my nerves before, like when I first, you know, was made aware of Stephen A. Smith and was watching him. But there's just so many smart people covering basketball these days, like people who, like, if you find them on podcasts or YouTube, you know, all these people who us mainly, but, like, who just know deep, like, you know, the intricacies of what's actually going on. And the more you listen to that, you listen to Stephen A. and some of these people on ESPN, it's like, what the fuck are you guys even talking about?
Big Perk. Well, it's crazy, man. Like, ESPN, of all places, like, lay off like 100 people, different journalists.
All they're good people. And they, like, Zach Lowe.
And then they pay $200 million for fucking him to be sitting there, best annoying. Seats in the house, pretty well, fucking playing solitaire with the games going on, just so he can give half-assed takes at the halftime show off a game he wasn't watching. And then you look over on, like, TNT, who has, you know, even basketball, you know, wise, obviously the Inside the NBA crew is, like, very highly regarded. You know, sometimes their takes, I mean, they're getting a little over the hill, and I think they know that as well. They're more there for the entertainment these days. But, like, fuck, man. They've only been taking over, like, the hockey side for, you know, the American broadcasts only recently. But they're fucking, like, Wayne Gretzky on there giving takes, man. Like, they've got guys who have actually won. Like, they had Henrik Lundqvist, who was, like, one of the best goalies of the modern era. Like, they've got real fucking analysts there, pardon me. The NFL, there's pretty much every broadcast has very knowledgeable people, whether you're talking about the journalists or the color presentators, you know, it's across the board so much better than what the NBA has supplied. And again, if you want to talk about growing the game, Adam Silver, maybe fucking try and clean this shit up from your broadcasting partners, because I think everyone's kind of, I think everyone's off the Stephen A. train at this point. Like, it was funny at first, but now it's just getting sad.
Now that you mention it and talking about Perk, and like, I'm thinking about all the former players who are like commentators. None of them are like that good. Like, maybe the best is Richard Jefferson, but even he isn't like, I'm not like wowed by like his insights ever. Fucking Channing Frye. Who was it? Which Morris twin was on more recently giving just absolutely ridiculous fucking shit.
That was another, with fucking Stephen A and them. I'm like, what do I care what Marquise Morris thinks, man? Like, genuinely, what do I care?
Udonis Haslam comes on and spews, you know, heat propaganda, basically. Like, there's a lot of just...
Dude, the best NBA, presenters now are like the podcast hosts, like Jeff Teague and Matt Barnes and Stack. Like,
yeah, that's great.
Those guys were like, you know, fringe all-stars, you know, throughout their, actually, I think combined, like Jeff Teague might've been the only one of those guys. I don't know if Steven Jackson ever got an all-star nod. If he did, it was probably like once. Matt Barnes definitely didn't. But they bring on guys like former athletes and stuff they talk with. Like, they're not covering the game live as it's happening or anything. Like, even like some of these coaches that they have here, like they're not, there's no, like, I love them. Like, Jack Armstrong is an elite color commentator, but when you bring it down to brass tacks, like, I mean, you know, Jack Armstrong was just like a, you know, smaller, you know, college coach from like 20 years ago. He didn't really. Yep. And then their other color commentator now is Junkyard Dog. Is it? Or no, Alvin Williams.
Alvin Williams.
I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
Alvin,
it's just like, Alvin Williams, you were cool. You were a good player. Like, you're not like, nobody fucking really is listening to what you're saying. You know what I mean? Like, no one's like, wow, that's that guy's an expert. I don't know. It's just, I think that there's a lot you can do with the broadcasting. But before we clock off for the podcast, as we await game 5, which a lot of you will be listening to this on Monday morning, is, you know, the day of tip off. So I hope you guys are getting ready for that. Mm-hmm. But Jordan, we've got a fucking trade, man. Let's go!
Put the horn in. Bam, 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 bam. Yeah,
it's actually insane that we got a trade during the NBA finals. I don't know if this has ever really happened. And if it has,
I don't remember a big one like this. There's like, but I swear there's been ones that have been like salary dumps, but not like players like this. But yeah, it's, I was shocked to see this today. When you texted, you texted me before I had seen it, which often happens because I don't have, you broke the news for me. I was sure it was a Durant thing. Then yeah, I know it's just Desmond Bane.
And yeah, I mean, Durant is still, I'm still seeing all these things about, you know, he's going to be traded very soon, and, you know, hopefully before the NBA draft. But yes, Desmond Bane was the big move here. A crazy trade here with the Orlando Magic. Desmond Bane to the Orlando Magic with the Memphis Grizzlies receiving KCP, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, Cole Anthony, and 4 unprotected first-round picks, and that's this year's 16th overall pick, the Phoenix Suns' first-round pick in 2026, the Magic's unprotected 2028, and then unprotected 2031st, and then a pick swap that is likely going to be done in 2029. That's not 100% finalized, I don't believe, at the time of recording this. But still, 4 pick swaps, or 4 first-round picks, pardon me, unprotected and pick swap. Kind of like the Mikhail Bridges haul that was sent over to Brooklyn from the Knicks. This is a crazy one, man. This is a really, really wild trade. I've seen people talking about it. I mean, if you are the Milwaukee Bucks and you actually are interested in trading Giannis at all this offseason, you are fucking salivating and licking your chops at the fact that you are going to pretty much have to ask for like half of a roster and your entire inventory of draft picks. Yeah, because... like Desmond Bane is a solid player. Like, don't get me wrong. He is a good player. He's a great offensive shooter. But, man, what the fuck are the Magic thinking? Like, honestly, 4 unprotected first-round picks for a guy who's never even made an All-Star game? It's just – it's crazy to me. He's under contract still, I believe, for the next 4 years. Maybe 3. But every single year, his contract is backloaded. So every single year, he's going to become more and more expensive. So it's one of those things where it's like, if things don't go well with this trade, it's just going to age worse and worse and worse as it goes. I believe the last year of his contract, he's going to be owing, or he's going to be owed, pardon me, $44 million. So this is a really risky move here for the Magic. But But they're going all in with this new core four of Jalen Suggs, Desmond Bane, Paolo Banchero, and Franz Wagner, which, I mean, on paper is a very solid team, especially in this wide-open Eastern Conference coming into 2026.
Yeah, and that's where I've landed. Like, my initial reaction was kind of shock, and obviously shock at the four unprotected fucking picks. Like, that's just too many for Desmond Bane. I don't care what the situation 100%. Is. It's too many.
There's very few guys out there, I think, that four unprotected first-round picks really make sense to get. Didn't make sense for Mikal Bridges. Doesn't make sense for this either.
And I would say, like, I know Mikal Bridges, his stock is pretty low right now, and he didn't look great, but, like, I think most people would think that Mikal Bridges is better than Desmond Bane, like, by even a decent
all-around game
margin, like, depending on who
you
talk to.
More versatile.
Like, I understand he just had a kind of shit playoffs, but, like, I don't know. I think at least where their stock was at the time of each of these respective trades, like, I think Mikal Bridges, most people thought of it as better, and even there was outrage at that point with the number of picks going out for that. So that's a little crazy to me. But the more I'm thinking about it, like, first of all, KCP and Cole Anthony, that's like a nothing. Like, you are not taking any risk or losing anything in terms of the players. KCP was a god awful signing for them. Like, just absolutely horrific. He shot so
that might actually be
three.
The best part of this for the honestly. The maybe that's why they had to, maybe it was gonna be
maybe.
Three first round picks. They had to throw
and
in an,
like,
extra first
we're taking
just to
this
get rid of KCP.
Fucking guy. Yeah, exactly. So he's a terrible contract there that just didn't pan out. It was a smart signing. Don't get me wrong. You go and get an NBA champion twice, by the way, with Lakers and the Nuggets. Mm-hmm. A guy who played that sort of off ball shooting role really well, but it just looked like he was, whatever Anthony Edwards did to him two playoffs ago, he just has not recovered from. And Cole Anthony, it's like Cole Anthony, I like him as a player. He's a nice player. He was not, he didn't really have a future on the Magic there, really. I know he was, a decent bench guy for them. But so from the standpoint of who you're giving up, that's really nothing to get a player as good as Desmond Bane. So then when you go into the picks, it's like, well, yes, it could be a bit disastrous depending on, if things just really don't work out for us. But, like, if we're as good as we think we're going to be, these first round picks aren't going to be that good. So ultimately, like, maybe we can swing this. So I'm kind of zagging from the public opinion a little bit. I actually like this trade for the Magic, because I really do think that core four that you mentioned is really, like, that fits together really well, like, synergistically.
They're all pretty young still.
Yeah, young, all in the same timeline generally. Obviously, Franz and Paolo, like, we know that, how good they've both been individually, and the vision is for them to, be like a Brown and Tatum type of awesome wing duo. And Jalen Suggs, who had a really good season before he went down with injury. Like, I think people have already sort of forgotten how good he looked, in the early part of this year. I think Desmond Bane is like a perfect backcourt guy with him, because you can kind of switch responsibilities a little bit. Like, Desmond Bane had to play a lot of, basically point guard in Memphis with the amount of time that John Morant missed over the years, and just the sort of democratic way in which they played. Like, Desmond Bane, he's totally happy to be on the ball, but he's really good, obviously, as a shooting guard next to Suggs, who's a bit of a combo himself. Solid defense from both of those guys. So that four, I do really like. I said to you, maybe they could use a bit of an upgrade at center. I know they got Wendell Carter. They've got Goga down there. And Mo Wagner. So, they're doing decently
Jonathan
there.
Isaac plays a lot of the five, but I don't really know much. You're getting out of the preacher man these days.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, you look at that starting five as a whole, like, I do like that. So I'm actually, I 100% I think it's an overpay, but just in terms of what you end up with here from a player and roster perspective, I think the Magic, I give them props for kind of going all in a little bit. And for saying, look, we've got a team. And also, we talked about, this year and going back to last year, how fucking awful the offense was, how they needed a shooter,
how they needed
another person in that backcourt to bolster the depth. And, that's exactly what they've done. So, I can't get mad at them for doing something I've been screaming at them to do for over 2 years. Even if the price is a little exorbitant here. So I like the move for the Magic. I think they got a chance to be pretty good next year.
Yeah, no, I agree that they will be better and that they'll kind of live up to a little bit more of the hype that we had kind of coming into this season that, you know, obviously it didn't really pan out the way that they thought. But
and this is a, because yeah, to me, it's a more puzzling move for the Grizzlies, actually.
Yes. Well, and this also came out of kind of nowhere there. Yeah. And we'll kind of touch on the Grizzlies side of this trade as well in a second. But for the Magic, yeah, it's a lot to give up for a guy like Desmond Bane. But I do agree that like this is like I can respect an organization that is like not just sitting on their hands and they're being like, oh, maybe we'll sign two role players and something will work, or we'll just keep running this back until it works or until somebody demands a trade, like, and letting the wheels just fall off. Like, they are trying to be proactive. They're trying to get better. They're patching up the holes that they need to, you know, keep the ship afloat. So I can definitely respect it. Do I think that they gave up a little more than they needed to? Yes. But, I do agree. And like I said kind of in the beginning there, like, this is the year that the East is going to be open. Like, there's a lot of teams that are going to skyrocket up the standings. Like, I genuinely know, like, the Celtics are still going to be a solid team, but, you know, who knows how much Jason Tatum we're going to see next year, if any.
And what their roster is going to look like, because they need to try and save some money here before the season starts. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's like and the Cavs, I mean, I know how that all fell apart last year. You know, they still could just run it back and see, but, you know, there might be moves that they're going to be making. Like,
yep.
There's a lot up in the air in the Eastern Conference. It's kind of a Mad Max situation out of the East. Whereas the West is like just gladiator kingdom, you know, everyone's just going head to head, you know, axes to shields and such. But over here for the Grizzlies, very odd. Like I can say I like that they moved Desmond Bane because I don't think the backcourt of Bane and Morant was working anymore. I know a lot of the time they also even experimented with Bane at the three, which I hated. He's just
way too small. Marcus Smart at the two and Bane at the three.
It's just crazy to me. Even this year they did a lot of Scottie Pippen Jr. at the two and John Morant and then Desmond Bane. Like, it's just too small. And like the modern NBA, I think that we're finally kind of getting back into the era of, like, again, we've seen it, like, bigs are dominating again. Like, big men who actually get active in the paint or get possessions, you know, attacking the rim, they've been dominating these really small ball lineups. So I do like it. I also want to say that Desmond Bane is not 6'6". I need to measure him myself at this point.
How long are his arms? God,
wingspan. Wingspan is negative to his height. I'm pretty sure, I swear to God, he's 6'4" or 6'3", and then all of a sudden someone gave him an extra couple inches.
Sorry. Is he listed at 6'6"?
He's listed at 6'6". I usually Google it right now. I'm telling you, he's not 6'6".
No, I'm not saying no way to him being, I believe you that he's listed, but yeah, there is no way he's 6'6". Yeah. That's Kobe's height.
That's what I was going to say. He's not Kobe's height. That's MJ's height. Yeah, it's insane. But apparently 6'6". I don't buy it. Maybe the Magic think that he's 6'6". They're going to show up and he's like a...
they're like, rescind the fucking trade.
Yeah.
This guy's a T-Rex toy.
Yes. But I don't like... I didn't like the backcourt fit there with Morant and Bane. And, you know, I honestly thought it was more likely they were going to move Jaw just because of all the bullshit.
Well, they might still.
And everything. And that's the thing. This might be like the first of many moves that we see here for the Grizzlies.
I think it might be for them.
They're going into a rebuild. You know, not a lot of teams stack up all these picks unless they're also looking and they're like, okay, now we got four picks to throw at a Kevin Durant or Giannis Antetokounmpo, you know, which would be an insanity if that's how they wanted to route this.
Yeah,
but I mean you nailed it with you know, KCP and Cole Anthony are pretty much nothing. Like, you can put KCP in the starting lineup; he's a defensive guy. Take that responsibility away from guarding the best perimeter player, so John Morant can just focus offensively. That's good. Yep. Cole Anthony, I don't even know if you're gonna fucking play at all. Like, you might get like 5-6 minutes off the bench. Like, you are probably gonna be the third string point guard, maybe even like backup two at the best. It's the players really don't matter in this one, unfortunately, you know, for their career trajectory. But yeah, if you're getting four picks for Desmond Bane, I think you got to be happy. That Phoenix first round pick is a juicy one. You know, who knows what that team's going to look like at the end of next season. So you get a top 16 pick in this year's draft, and there's a lot of talent in this one. So I think that the Grizzlies, they got the most that they possibly could out of a Desmond Bane, you know, trade. So I would be like, I'm honestly kind of on the side of, this is almost a win-win trade. Again, a little bit too much given up on the side of Orlando, but I don't hate the trade from either side. I get why both did it. It's not one of those ones that leaves me completely scratching my head. So I'm cool with it, and it was a nice surprise. It's always good when we get these trades out of thin air. There was no rumors that Desmond Bane was even on the trade market.
No, yeah. I mean, the Grizzlies situation was one to monitor in the offseason, yes. But yep. I wouldn't have put my money on Bane being the first guy to be moved, like, because you know he's been one of their more consistent players. But yeah, if you're looking at it from a basketball fit as is, if they don't make any more moves, like hypothetically, KCP is a really nice addition, or a nice backcourt partner for Ja Morant, a guy who can stretch the floor, doesn't need the ball really, can sort of just provide that spacing and, like you said, play solid defense. I don't know if he's at the point when in his career where he's kind of over the hill. It certainly looked like it this last year, but maybe he's just having a down year.
He wasn't even fucking shooting the rock well. Like his defense was okay. Like it was bad.
Yeah, but the interesting thing now is like normally when teams like the Grizzlies like make a trade, you can understand based on how they made the trade what direction they're going to go, and sort of it indicates where they're going. But like you mentioned there, it's like, are you getting these picks for a rebuild, or are you getting them to load up to make an offer for one of these big free agents or just potentially a disgruntled superstar here? Because I think at least Memphis is making the right call that they're not good enough as constructed to just stand pat and say, oh, we'll be better next year. Like, oh, once we get Brandon Clark back, like I think it's pretty clear they needed to make a move. So I think that's good. And whether it's, look, we're just going to sit this out, like Ja is young enough. Also, maybe we explore trading Ja anyway, but like we've got Scottie Pippen Jr. here. We're going to just get a boatload of picks and just wait out and see how the next few years in this insanely loaded West play out. If that's the route they want to go, I can't fault them for that. That might be the best idea. Like it's a bloodbath out there. It's crazy. And I didn't see Memphis getting that far next year unless they were going to make a major move. But if you're going to, it's interesting to think maybe they're going another direction of the star hunting because, you got four unprotected picks now in addition to whatever you've got on your own. And maybe you can even make another move or two to gather even more if you need to and then go after, if you want to make a Giannis offer like that, that's an interesting pairing. Like if you were going to keep Ja in this scenario, like. Giannis and Ja and potentially if you still have Jaren Jackson Jr. like that's
I think a triple J Giannis front court would be pretty
nasty. Pretty nice. Yep, that's pretty nice. And even Kevin Durant, like that's the prototypical wing player that I've thought that the Grizzlies have just been missing for so long. Going back, since they lost Dylan Brooks, but including the Dylan Brooks years, it's like they haven't really had that prototypical scorer. So you get that in Kevin Durant and him and Jaren Jackson Jr. in that front court. Also very nice, complimentary. It's interesting.
Can you give the Suns back one of their first round picks?
Yep. That might be enticing or maybe a reason why they, even wanted that, potentially. But I also just wouldn't be surprised if we get more chatter and more buzz about Durant being on the move and they just kind of tear this thing down, maybe keep Jackson, maybe not. I mean, I don't know what their plans are, but they've definitely, this is the warning shot, the cannon fire that there's more to come somehow here. But yeah, I think like you talk about like the East and the West, it's like, oh, the motivation for the Magic to do this move is, we don't know what Boston's going to be. We don't know what Cleveland. We don't know Philly. Like any of these teams that were supposed to be good going in the last year,
like a conference finals team,
100%. I was even thinking as you were talking, I'm like, the Magic could be the second or third seed next year.
Yeah,
like 100%. Genuinely, like
if they can just get their bench up a little bit, like
if they got a little bit of money to spend, like that's not out of the realm of possibility. But then in the West, it's like you have this inverse pressure of like this conference is so fucking good, like. Are we just going to waste another year of, trying to convince ourselves that we can compete with teams that we just know we can't? And it's like, the Grizzlies, they're just, getting out of the business. And, there'll be time to do this down the road, in more detail later when we see where all the chips have fallen. But like, remember a few years ago that this Memphis team that was so fucking cocky and looked like they were going to run the West for like five years, like already one of their big three is out the door. It's crazy how these things can change.
And to go full circle, I mean, we were talking about it, you know, when this final started, that, you know, people talk about this Thunder team. Oh, they're going to be back here. Oh, the Pacers. Yeah, they, you know, it's a bit of a fluky run, but, you know, they've shown that they're a real team. This is why this final matters. That's why it's interesting, because you never, ever, ever, ever can guarantee that you're going to be back in that situation again. Because, you can look like you're going to be the team of the future, and then you'll never make the playoffs again with that core. Hell, look at the Magic. They had that that good series with the Cavs, and then they missed the playoffs entirely the next year. So it's
At the OKC the first time around, Durant, Harden, Westbrook never got back there as a group. And that seemed like the most done deal of done deals that they would be back.
Yep.
They never were.
Yeah. So well, let us know at Big Dog Ball Talk what you guys thought of Game 4 of the NBA Finals, predictions for Game 5 and beyond, as well as your reactions to this Magic and Grizzlies trade. Who won? Who lost? What do you like? Where is Kevin Durant and Giannis going to go? Are they going to be roped into these four first-round picks? Let us know. Give us your picks and predictions at Big Dog Ball Talk, X, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook. Roll the old heads out there. We will be back after Game 5. And until then, this has been Big Dog Ball Talk. My name is Jordan Flagel, and as my good friend Jordan always says,
it was yesterday, technically, as we're recording this Saturday. Happy birthday to Donald Trump. Loved your little dictator parade that no one showed up to, buddy. That was really funny. I was looking at, have you seen the tanks going by? Like, shout out to our sponsor, the UFC. Just put it.
Oh,
up
man. For people who aren't familiar with me too much outside of the podcast, huge MMA guy, huge fight fan. And, yeah, it's really fucking a huge bummer when the main card's about to start and they have to do a full 10-minute presentation of him walking out to the ring. All the fighters are sucking his dick after the fights, and oh man, it ruins it. Keep politics out of sports.
Shout out to you, lives. Donald Trump. Hope you had a great birthday there, pal.
Follow us on
huge turnout. Also, go Oilers, go. I mean, this might be the last gasp. Again, Brad Marchand. I almost have to tip my cap to him at a certain point. My God. But this is where legends are made. Connor and Leon, all you guys. Please, God.
The Oilers are on their way.
That better work.